Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. So we'd like to welcome Monami Molik and Shoshi Dosha to the show. Monami is a founding member and director of DRUM, Desai Rising Up and Moving. DRUM is based in New York City and was founded in 1989 as one of the first low-income South Asian community-based organizations for social justice in the U.S. And Shoshi is the youth organizer for DRUM and runs the youth power campaign, Education Not Deportation. They're here to talk about their new report that was authored along with the Urban Justice Center titled Education Not Deportation, Impacts of New York City School Safety Policies on South Asian Immigrant Youth. Welcome, Monami and Shoshi.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Monami, could you start with describing for folks that what is the South Asian population and what does it look like in New York? I mean, we understand that, historically, Asians have been barred from immigrating to the United States, so only those with the most privilege were allowed to enter, and that tended to be the brain drain. And so with the advent of structural adjustment policies in third world countries through the IMF and World Bank, the demographics is actually shifting. Can you tell people what that population looks like?
Right, sure. The South Asian community in New York City is one of the largest, if not the largest concentration in the U.S. The community is approximately a million people, and predominantly at this point, most of the South Asians here are from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and increasingly from Nepal, and from India, from places primarily in Punjab. South Asians that are migrating into New York City in what we call the newer wave of migration, which is in the last 15 years or so, are mainly being brought in as low-wage migrant workers. So many people here are work in industries such as taxi driving, restaurant work, domestic work. Most of our members are low-wage workers as such. And it's very different from the population of post-1965 migrants who are mainly professionals.
Mm. So I have a question for Shoshi. First of all, I read the report. It's really excellent. I encourage people to go check it out on the website. Just to kind of connect some of the work that we're doing here in Los Angeles around kind of the education, not incarceration piece. In Los Angeles, there's a special order called Special Order 40 that stops police and law enforcement officials for asking about documentation. In LA County. And I know that New York City has a similar order called Executive Order 41, which is supposed to do the same thing. My question is, actually on school campuses, what is the actual practice? Do police ask? And then if they do, what is the accountability or what can students do to push back against that?
Well, there are, right now also the Executive Order 41 and Chancellor Regulation A101 protect immigrant students from having their report status being reported. But what we're seeing in practice, it's just not going and asking them directly what's your immigration status. It's more happening indirectly. Like, for example, when students apply for lunch, and in the lunch form, they say they have to specify their social security number, and if they don't have it, they have to write in none. So that, that puts them in a threat because we don't know where this information is going and who's collecting this information. So things like that, during AP tests or, going to scholarships, they always ask for, student social security numbers, and that puts undocumented students at risk. So we're seeing that's happening in an indirect way, but not necessarily, directly. But right now, also putting in policing, NYPD officers within our schools, that also makes immigrant students unsafe, knowing that there is a threat, they could ask your status anytime.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's one of the things that I actually read is that after, Bloomberg's takeover of the school system, in terms of his school safety initiatives, they were saying that basically one of them was to put 150 police officers in 12 middle and high schools, which just seems crazy to me in terms of the metal detectors and all that and whatnot going in that.
Yeah, we've been definitely seeing that, and those high schools are predominantly from poor neighborhoods and poor people of color go to the school.
In terms of people of color, is it mostly South Asian? Is it black? Is it Latino? What are the breaks?
The Dirty Dozen school predominantly are there in the Bronx and Brooklyn are most of them, and their population is highly Latino and African-American. But what we're seeing within Queens, because we did our surveys in Queens, those high schools as well, even though there's a high population of South Asian students, and it's just like slowly it's being also, you know, infested with police or, you know, metal detectors.
So, I mean, one of the interesting things, and we'll maybe in a couple minutes talk about what all the recommendations that you actually brought, there were four of them, one of them talks about basically working with parents and students in collaboration to find out what are all alternatives to cops and more cops and more cops. Mm-hmm. So I think the first question I want to ask, and maybe Mona, me can take this first part and you can take the second part, is what is the actual level of, you know, quote unquote crime or disciplinary issues on school campus? Because I think a lot of times it's really, really hyped up. And so how does that play out in the school campuses?
I mean, Shoshi could probably answer it better, but, you know, I think that you're right. It is a lot of hype. Youth of color, and in our context, Muslim youth are being criminalized and demonized in a certain way. And so it's, I think, while some statistics indicate that it's on the decline, instead the policing practices are more and more about, I mean, the safety policies are more and more about policing and enforcement. And it's very parallel to what's happening in general around immigration reform in the U.S., which is the larger issue that Drum organizes around, that it's the, sort of the same idea of thinking that we're going to solve the country's immigration, quote-unquote, problems by creating more border policing and security. And what all of this does is it's based on an assumption of criminalizing people who are immigrants, who are low-wage workers, who are low-income youth, and not providing safe and equal access to the necessary services like housing, employment, education.
And I think on top of that, the other thing that it serves to do is to actually scare people, and I think that comes across in your report, is just that people are kind of walking like they're going through checkpoints, or they have to have their pass, their school schedule, or else they're going to be, you know, rounded up and put into police vans. So the other thing, I guess the second part of that question, maybe so she can talk about it, in terms of some of the first thinking about alternatives to police, what are those alternatives that you guys are talking about?
Well, our recommendation, we clearly state that, you know, removing police officers or school safety agents per se, it's a long-term goal. It's like a long-term process. But we're saying in meanwhile, like having an evaluation system where, you know, youth and parents or community members are actually empowered to make decisions around their schooling, because what we're seeing right now within our New York City schools, there is no structure to have, you know, youth actually making decisions about their education system. So right now what we're seeing that, you know, youth needs to be given that power to make changes, or, you know, even, like, say, able to say no to certain things. Like, most of the students, they don't want, you know, so school safety agents or police officers or metal detectors, but they don't have, they just, you know, just said that you have to follow it. So what we're saying that as an alternative to having actually an evaluation and then creating a safety strategy that works for both the youth and, you know, with the Department of Education together, creating something that will be an alternative to them. And investing in education, like most of the schools that these youth go to, like they have like 4,000 students and 4 guidance counselors. So, like, you know, there's like many resources that need to be put into education and resources that's going to make their, you know, education even advance, you know, per se, instead of, you know, policing them and putting them into, you know.
Shoshi, can you talk about some of the stories that of the South Asian youth that you interviewed, and what was the impact post 9/11? And can you tell us some of the more glaring stories that came out of the report?
Well, there are many stories, and it just, you know, it was a common thread, and they were saying, like, especially after 9/11, like, you know, youth were already in fear with all these hate crimes that were happening to them, but when they would go into school, you know, they'll have, like, the police officers or safety agents call them names, like, go back to your country, or are you Osama bin daughter, and things like that, like, and a lot of the youth were saying. But what we're saying lately, like, even after when the youth would go out and the police would profile them saying that they were cutting class, that even though they weren't, it was just like, you know, they were just walking out, but they fit a profile, just young people, you know, walking together after school, but still they're saying, you know, you fit a profile, you know, you're cutting school. Or, like, I'm one of the students, like I said before about, like, you know, putting their lunch form in. Like, you know, one of the students, they don't even eat lunch because they're undocumented, you know, like they're afraid their information is going to be known by somebody and it's going to come to them. And actually, recently that we worked on a case last year, her name is Tasnuba. She was a 16-year-old Bangladeshi woman who was deported to Bangladesh. But, you know, the information what we saw was definitely a collaboration between, you know, the police department or the, you know, Department of Education with the DHS. So, you know, she was later deported. So, like, we're hearing many cases where, you know, there's it's a real threat that's out there and it's affecting, you know, the lives of many youth.
So what happened to that student, Tanishba?
Ms. Nuba, she was deported to Bangladesh, and now, you know, she's, like, she was practically raised here. She was here since she was 4 years old. So, like, you know, her entire life changed, and her family had to go back, and, you know, they're just in a devastating situation right now.
So, Monami, with the release of this report, have you gotten a response from the Department of Education or the mayor's office?
Mm-hmm. There's definitely, the report's already made a lot of waves, and I think the reason is that since 9/11, we've seen on the ground collaboration happening all around us, in our homes, in our workplaces, in the train stations, in schools, in the Department of Motor Vehicles offices. And we know it's happening, but whenever case after case, year after year, when we take this to the Department of Homeland Security, they say, no, we're not collaborating with local law enforcement or city agencies. But then city agencies will say they do report people who have outstanding deportation orders to Homeland Security. So nobody wants to own up to the fact that there is collaboration happening, even in places where there's protection against sharing of immigration status. And obviously the post-9/11 national security framework justifies all of this. So in Tashnuba's case, she was somehow being investigated after she visited the police on her own about something else. She was being investigated for her religious and political beliefs. Mm-hmm. A lot of these were beliefs that she, that statements that she made in school. Her and another, an African young woman who's 16, was also deported. None of the charges that or possibilities around terrorism amounted to anything, but this is what we've seen time and time again. So we've gotten calls back, and already the Youth Power members like Shoshi and other students have met with several city council people, Department of Education officials, the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs, and we're working towards some local city council members have expressed interest in holding a hearing in city council on the conditions of undocumented students in the public high schools, and we hope that we're able to hold such a hearing in city council to bring out the issues that thousands of young people who are undocumented face in the school system.
Well, thank you so much. I encourage everyone to go on to the website, www.drumnation.org, and the telephone number to Drum is 718-205-3036. Pick up the report, read it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that ends today's program of Voices from the Frontlines. This is your co-host, Damon Azali and Tam Bang Lu. We'd like to thank our guests, Ian Anaba, Monami Malik, and Shoshi Doza. Today we heard music from Iced Life, John Lee Hooker, Kanabunga Man, which you're listening to right now. Oh, actually, no. Ramsey Lewis, which you're listening to right now. And you can listen to previous Voices shows at www.thestrategycenter.org. And we'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, production assistant, Lisa Adler. And we would like to see you next week, listen to you next week on Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Jose Benavides is our engineer. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. Thanks.